listen to Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for Indians, but he is also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to them.
Before we get ready to go, my wife was here, and she was the president of the Association of Black Psychologists a couple of years ago, and she was responsible for taking about 500 people, including about 300 black psychologists, to Ghana, West Africa, for their national conference. The reason I point that out is because I want to say a couple of things, and I'm going to go out of bounds with what I have to say relative to what we've been talking about. First of all, I grew up in Brooklyn, and I saw, looking back on my life, I saw about 30 of my friends die, you know, getting shot, overdosing on drugs, any number of things that took them off the planet, you know, beautiful brothers. So as I started to become more conscious, I looked around, I started asking this very important question. I think the most important question that I asked myself and that you can ask yourself is why. And I wanted to find out what was going on. So I began to change. I began to examine everything. I don't like to use the word critically, but I started to really check things out. So I went through a very, very serious change. I mean, serious change. And what my wife and I did, we decided that we were going to drop out from the system. We delivered our two of our three children at home using midwives. She didn't take any medication. We didn't go to a doctor. She talked me into doing that, but it was a beautiful experience for me to be there to help deliver our children. They were born, by the way, 2 years apart on the same day, and our oldest daughter helped us deliver our children. We also changed our diets. We saw the hospital system was killing our people, so we changed our diets. We have been vegan for about 30 years. That means no meat at all in any form, no dairy products, no sugar, no white flour, the same thing that Dr. Whitaker talked about. Because we understood that we were in a war, and I want to emphasize that to you. We are in a war. We left New York and went to North Carolina, and really, it's on her again. We decided that we were not going to go in debt because the new form of slavery was economic slavery. Well, we got some land. We're very fortunate, and we built our own house. We built a log house. It took us 16 months. We worked night and day every day for the 16 months, and she was out there with a chainsaw in the cold and the rain, and we worked and we built the house so we would not have to give white people any money. I taught on the college level for a number of years at a so-called black college, and I'm down against black colleges. I'm going to tell you straight up, because some of the madness that's going on in these schools. But what I want to say is that there are two things going on the planet now. One is that when white people came to us and said, we're going to free you, we're going to emancipate you from the plantation, what they did was extended the boundaries of the plantation and made it an international plantation, made us think that we were free. In addition to that, they made every white person on earth a plantation master or owner. So there are two things in operation. We are in an international prison. It's not just in America, but everywhere we go, our people are dying. So the things that are in operation on this planet is that white people want to kill us. I want you to understand that. They want to kill you. And it has nothing to do with what the kind of degree you have, what kind of car you have, what kind of title you have, what fraternity you belong to, what religion you belong to. They want to kill you because that is part of their plan. There are any number of reasons why they want to do that. I'm not going to waste my time trying to figure out why they want to kill us. But I know that's what they want to do. And they want to do it in many different ways. Psychological, economic, cultural, spiritual, social, and biological, chemical, electromagnetic. They want to kill you. But they also want to make money in the process of your death. Now, I saw a brother when I was coming and he was smoking a cigarette. So now he's going to kill himself, but they're going to make money off of his death process. The other thing is that they want us to, if they don't kill us, like they tried to kill the brother by beating him up in New Orleans, if they don't kill us that way, or shooting like they killed the brother in Cincinnati, or like they killed Malice Green in Detroit, or like they killed Greenwich up in Pittsburgh, if they don't come out right and kill us straight, they want to get us to kill ourselves. Now, these are the only two operations on the planet. The other thing is that there's only one nigger on the planet. I never use that word. This is the first time I've used it. I don't even think that word. But there's only one nigger on the planet. And the nigger that's on the planet is the one that is destroying the water, the one that's polluting the air, the one that is exploiting people and resources. And the only nigger on the planet is the white man and the white woman. And then our people are not niggers. We are imitation niggers. Now, what we have to do is we have to devise a system or a plan for ourselves. And I said earlier that each one of you is a system. And everything that you do, every thought that you think, either you are supporting white world terror domination by your actions, what you buy, what you wear, where you go, what you eat, how you use your time. You are either supporting the white people in their process of death, or you're for African liberation. It's one or the other. And if we don't use our time wisely, then we are engaging in a form of subtle suicide. Because as I said earlier, their system is still going on. They still have these images on TV that are going on. They're still warehousing our children in special ed, giving them Ritalin. They're no jobs. We're filling the hospitals. So their system is not stopping. And then finally, I want to say that we need one idea. And we're not thinking about a solution to the problem. We're dealing with all these other things, but these are diversions from the solution to the problem. And we have to start to think about a solution to the problem so that these young brothers and sisters who are here now, who are 15, 16, and 17, are not here 25 years later talking about these same problems. Now, how do I know that the white people know that we are going to come up with a solution to the problem? I know it because they have retina scans, they have what they call racial profiling, DNA banks, and they're monitoring our people to try to prevent the one person from coming up with the one idea. And the one idea is how we are going to exterminate white people, because that, in my estimation, is the only conclusion I have come to. We have to exterminate white people off of the face of the planet to solve this problem. Now, I don't care whether you clap or not, but I'm saying to you that we need to solve this problem because they are going to kill us. And I will leave on that. So we have to just set up our own system and stop playing and get very serious and not be diverted from coming up with a solution to the problem. And the problem on the planet is white people.
Be hard to follow that one. You can get as black as you want. I don't know if you can get that.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
I think Angry Indian is one of those people who likes to walk up to two guys and say, let's see you and him fight.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, this is the Angry Indian. Welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. I was able to get him back. Malachi Daniel, otherwise known as Fanonian. He's been on the show before. we're going to talk about the Dunn verdict and a few other things that, in my opinion anyway, made the Dunn verdict possible. I don't understand the math. We have a white man who gets into it with a young black man. And look, we all have. We all have. We've all dealt with the snot-nosed young man, okay? But, you know, after a certain age, man, you know, you realize that, you know, this is a kid, that, you know, that this is a youth that has very little experience, that is probably just grandstanding. You know, the idea of, you know, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, excuse me, pardon me, sir. You know, somebody at the, I mean, young people ask me for the time and I'm waiting for the bus. They don't know how to say, excuse me, sir, do you have the time? Thank you, sir. They, you know, good day or whatever. You know, they don't know how to do that. They don't know how to do that. They don't know how to say, excuse me. You know, and everybody wants to blame the liberals, you know, like my pops, you know, everything that was wrong with the world. You know, he blamed on the hippies, he blamed on the communists, right? He blamed on the liberals. You know, he blamed on you know, women to some degree. You know, and he wasn't, you know, we all like to say, oh, he wasn't a bad guy. Well, he wasn't. He wasn't evil, but, you know, he really believed that, you know, he believed all of the propaganda that was put out by the John Birch Society. We're talking about a black man now, a black Indian, right, who believed the John Birch Society. He believed. He didn't believe the racism part. See, he just believed the rest of it. You know, the parts that didn't relate to him. And when you have a disconnect like that, you can have a verdict like the Dunn trial. So what I'm getting to here is we have a case where this white cat didn't like how this black man spoke to him. This young man, really. And let's look at this, you know, in terms of Trayvon Martin, in terms of every 28 hours. You know, in terms of a black male being more threatening when he's still in his sexual prime. Because, you know, we have to talk about that. We have to talk about that. You know, the first real film that, if you want to talk about black cinema in terms of modern black cinema, when we talk about Melvin Van Peebles' Sweet Sweetback, we have to talk about the sexual aspects of this. And this fear that, you know, many white men have, this anger that many white men have, this loathing, this, you know, unbridled animosity, to where we can now have a white man reach over, shoot into a vehicle, shoot everybody that's in the vehicle, kill one of these young men, drive off, you know, Furman here from the O.J. Simpson truck. We keep hearing about O.J. Simpson, right? And nobody wants to talk about Furman and how he admitted framing people and beating people. And, you know, nobody wants to talk about that. And, you know, everybody likes to quote to me, the Republicans that I know, the white Republican and the black ones, that like to quote to me the Furman quote about how, you know, these people, they will shoot people and then go, you know, get fried chicken and watch television or what have you. Well, that who did in Jordan Davis and his pals, he drove off. Went to a hotel and ordered a pizza. Took the long way home. And, you know, I don't hear anybody in the press, you know, making that analogy between poor white trash. And we're going to use the terms that they use because I don't particularly believe in it. I think it's vulgar. But this is the terms, this is the mindset, the paradigm that we're dealing with now. Poor white trash who, you know, shoots a bunch of people. Drives off, you know, I mean, for nothing, really, you know, drives off, orders a pizza. You know, we don't hear any activity about white males. You know, we're not hearing about how white males are dangerous, even though white males are going around doing this. And then you talk about stand your ground and, you know, what is that supposed to mean? And then Trayvon Martin gets thrown up. But, you know, now we have this trial. So, you know, what is it that I'm really talking about? You know, what are you rambling about, Reverend? Okay, what I'm rambling about is the total lack of any logic around this verdict in the terms that the jury, it seems, was struggling on trying to find a way to not charge this man with murder. And what they ended up doing was they found him guilty of attempted murder for the brothers who were shot and injured but who did not die. But they had a mistrial on the man who did die. So, you know, we're living under a black president. You know, we have a black man running the Justice Department, and we have a Secretary of State who is black, right? Of color, right? We have powerful Republicans who talk a lot of shit but don't do nothing, like Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, General Colin Powell, retired General Colin Powell, right? You know, who, when he does say anything about race, they tell him to shut up and they put him right back in his place and he doesn't say anything. He stays in his place. You know, Oprah might make a side remark, but she's not leading the campaign to do any goddamn thing. Now, we're going to bring in Brother Fanonian. Now, like I said, you need to go check his work at Fanonian on Twitter. We've had him on here because he gives a Fanonian analysis. He gives a Fanonian deconstruction, if I want to go that far, in terms of Jacques Derrida, in terms of the school of thought that came around during the anti-colonial struggle. When the anti-colonial struggle was in its full swing, especially in terms of the French, in terms of Algeria, in terms of Indochine. You know, welcome back, Brother Daniels, to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thanks for having me, brother.
You know, if you can, you know, your initial thoughts, man, because when I first contacted you, you said you were still trying to let it all trickle down in terms of the logic behind this. And I do want to throw out the awkward thing before you answer this. Some of you might remember the West Point case. The military academy, well, the premier U.S. military academy, for that matter, West Point, where you had a case of four upperclassmen, three Christian, one Jewish, who attacked a black class. He was one of the first blacks at West Point. They had this long trial, and, you know, they had one of the most liberal lawyers available, and he had a black assistant, and, you know, they went through this trial, and what the decision was during the court martial, what the decision was that the black man beat himself up. Now, we have a case in New York City where, you know, where you are, Brother Daniels, where a man who was mentally ill was shot at by police, who ended up shooting bystanders, but charged the person that they were shooting at, who did not have a weapon, who was simply trying to dodge them in traffic, with the shootings.
Absolutely.
You know, so, yeah, I'm sorry I'm being long-winded because, you know, I'm just trying to work this out, you know, as you are, and trying to lay some kind of background for this. So, you know, Brother Daniels, if you will.
where do you start with, you know, with the Jordan Davis case? You know, I had some words with a gentleman on Twitter earlier, and I basically stated that people like Michael Dunn and Zimmerman were white men, and I do call George Zimmerman a white man, because by white American classification of race, Zimmerman is a white man, and he lives his life as a white man. And, I mean, that's very clear. But I said that men like this, pretty much they live their lives in fear, they live their lives in fear of black men, and they have these wet dreams of these confrontations that they'll one day have with, you know, term they like to throw around is thug or thugs, you know, and these things play over and over in a reel. So when any incident occurs, you know, they're not dealing with children, even if they are dealing with children. They're dealing with that black beast that they've played that encounter over and over in their minds. You know, that when that happens, that day when I have to deal with the enemy, this is how I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to dispatch him with extreme prejudice. What I said to this man was that if it hadn't been Trayvon Martin, if it hadn't been Jordan Davis, it would have been someone else's son. Because this is the mind of the American white male nationalist, and this is it's a pretty common mindset. And you don't hear this oftentimes from mainstream media. You won't hear this not even from black liberals quite often. Although, you know, I get the feeling that many black liberals will, I guess, try to change their tune, you know, in the probably in the coming months.
Somebody I haven't looked at, I believe it was Michael Smith, has a piece out on this verdict already. I'm not sure. I'm not looking at my Twitter account just now. I mean, yeah, there would be editorials written. There would be articles published. In the end, you know, nothing is going to happen. This is going to progress. We knew that this was going to happen. It's been going on. I mean, we still had the Malcolm X grassroots report that has been mentioned on Democracy Now. It's been mentioned on The Real News. It's been mentioned on Press TV. It's been mentioned on Russia Today. It's been mentioned by The Guardian, UK. But it has not been mentioned in the mainstream press in the United States or Canada, for that matter, or Mexico. You know, for the reason is that, you know, this is, I mean, you have to basically ask yourself if this is premeditated in terms of the Stand Your Ground law, and then ask yourself, who was it that came up with the Stand Your Ground law? You know, what was the funding behind that? You know, ALEC, the legislative council, you know, basically the capitalist group that is running around trying to privatize the entire country, the entire world, if they can get away with it. These are the people that were keeping the United States out of the South African boycott against apartheid. These are people who have, you know, worked very, very diligently to pretty much remove Detroit as a city, as a civic entity. I mean, you know, all of the black areas of that region are totally depressed. And then you have these pockets of wealth. And you have police forces that are increasingly also becoming more and more privatized. Just like the military becoming more and more privatized. So we've seen this already. You know, we have the militarization of the police. We have cameras being put into black neighborhoods, in Mexican neighborhoods, not to protect property, but to surveil the population. We've already had various cases when I was still living in Philly, where an entire neighborhood would be blocked off, and you had to show ID in order to proceed, or you had to find a way to walk around.
I've seen that here as well.
You know, it's happened sporadically, and now they're asking people for DNA swabs. I think it's in North Carolina.
I've heard that too.
You know, voluntary swabs, talking about, well, you know, we're just doing this, you know, this thing. You know, I mean, we're giving up our privacy. We're putting up everything about ourselves on Twitter, on Facebook. You know, we're pretending that we're really having a conversation with the person that you're actually communicating with on the other end. You could, like, Philip K. Dick and kind of say maybe you don't even really know who it is that you ever are communicating with on the other end. I mean, it's been shown that voices can be altered. You can be made to seem like you're saying things that you're not saying. I mean, anybody that's ever edited anything in terms of audio can verify that. So, you know, we're looking at a society basically of pure capitalism that in one sense elected someone like Barack Obama to keep capitalism alive, right? To keep it going, especially in terms of expansion, in terms of Africa, right? In terms of loosening the intellectual nuts and bolts of the left in the United States, and maybe to an extent Canada.
So putting the black masses to sleep.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole point, you know, to come in, get everybody's guard down, because if John McCain and Sarah Palin were doing all of this, there would be complaints, there would be marches, there would be resistance.
Exactly.
There would be resistance to the the XL pipeline and these partnerships and, you know, drop the trade, you know, the trade barriers, drop this, drop that, you know, drop regulation here, drop regulation there. We got the Fukushima cloud that has already, you know, starting to damage my region. You know, I mean, there's a lot of children being born with some serious birth defects in California behind this. You know, no one wants to eat the fish out here. The Pacific Rim, which is where most of the business over here comes from, they don't want to accept a lot of the foodstuffs anymore. They don't want to take the wheat because of the Monsanto thing. So, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to go on it. I'm just saying, we have a lot of confusion right now. You have a lot of people who are either simply trying to stay alive, or they're trying to keep up with the Joneses. And they're not really paying attention to what's happening because you're caught up, you know, either trying to survive or trying to keep up. And in the meantime, all of your rights are being taken away. So now here we have black men. Now, young black men have never really had any status in this society anyway. But, you know, there were, you know, pockets, at least that I can remember, where things were not so goddamn bad. But now, this is, you know, to the point where the public, the police, the military, they decide now, you know, whether or not black men can walk down the street, black men can apply for certain jobs. You know, of course, all of this is unofficial. But, you know, we have a case here.
Right. It's an unofficial Jim Crow.
It's an unofficial Jim Crow.
Being reinstituted.
You know, I mean, it's totally unofficial. Here you have, you know, these paradigms being set. And then, you know, grace under pressure. You have black men that are trying to cope. So instead of saying, okay, maybe if I study agriculture, like what was being discussed in the 60s, so that when African farmers need help, I can go out there and help them as one black man to another black man, right? To give them that aid. No, I want to be a basketball star. I want to be like Kanye West. I want to be like Jay-Z. I want to be an MMA fighter. I want to be in the NBA. I want to be in the NFL. And, you know, we're seeing that even, you know, recently, even being in the NFL and taking your team to the Super Bowl, you're still a thug. So this, to me, is why we can have a verdict like this. It's the same reason why you had a verdict with the West Point case. This nigga did it to himself. So evidently, they, you know, the jury's saying to themselves as white people, well, yeah, he overreacted, but, you know, I mean, how the hell do you find, you know, you shoot a car full of people, the people you don't kill, you get charged with attempted murder. Okay, we can deal with that. But the person that you did kill is a mistrial.
Right. It's not even, I mean, it, you know, it all gets lost within the legalese and doublespeak of the legal system. The right and wrong and the very clear common sense fact is that this young brother's not coming back. He's gone. And this man murdered him. He murdered him with full malice. You know, a lot of what you were speaking about, brother, I mean, obviously, for the folks that are listening, you know, you have to run through the steps. You and I know that there's a design. You know, if we look back over the last generation or more, and we look at the dismantling of black political organization, of black leadership, and we look at the political stooges that black political leaders who were murdered and imprisoned and many run into exile, who were replaced by, this is where we were supposed to end up. When we end up with people like Jesse Jackson's, and we end up with people like Al Sharpton, and, you know, and to a certain degree, I love Louis Farrakhan because I grew up with him. But it's very clear to me that, that Brother Farrakhan goes to a certain step and he doesn't step beyond that. Many of the Panthers who were my mentors, and many also former Black Liberation Army, were completely pissed off at Farrakhan for getting 1 million Africans to come to Washington and not offering them any political direction, any programs, any really clear campaigns to actually push us into the 21st century. So to me and to them, that was extremely suspect. And all of these people that I'm naming, and we can name many more, have contributed to the condition and the place in which we find ourselves, that African people in America find ourselves. And this was totally by design. Now we find ourselves in a place where, you know, we can find ourselves, obviously you can look at the prison industrial complex, the for-profit prisons, and you look at that and you see people who are actually being re-enslaved.
Oh, yeah. Here's the thing. I want to interrupt you because I'm hearing all this talk, Marissa, have you read, Melissa Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow? And I'm like, I've read parts of it, yeah. Man, I thought you'd really be excited about that. I'm like, look, the Black Panther Party self-defense have been talking about that for how long? Everything that you're telling me about was already discussed in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s when it became apparent what was happening. And if you want to go deeper, Garvey was talking about all of this.
Indeed.
But see, I'm not trying to, call Ms. Alexander out or anything, but I just want to point that they're waiting for, Bell Hooks or Ms. Alexander or, someone else with a PhD behind their name that comes from a white, like Skip Gates, that comes from that type of academic background. Not cultural background, but from that, in other words, somebody that's been vetted by the white community as legitimate. These are the books and the people that we're going to listen to. And I'm not knocking the woman for the book. I'm just saying that, this is not new, that, people have been trying to work against this and have been trying to inform about this. But, everyone wants to pretend that this is a new problem. It's kind of like dealing with the white liberal who says, why can't we move on from today? Why do you have to continue to talk about yesterday? But I'm like, what are you talking about yesterday? What you're talking about was happening yesterday is still happening, man.
Exactly. No, I was just going to say that, it's very clear that we have a black liberal and academic class who did exactly what they were supposed to do. And the most disturbing thing about it is that it seems now that many of them are, they're pretty arrogant about the role that they play within black people's oppression. It's very clear they're not interested. They're interested in, basically disappearing a whole part of black liberation history. They don't want to speak about, that they barely speak about SNCC. They definitely don't want to speak about the Black Panther Party, and they sure as hell don't want to talk about the Black Liberation Army. They don't want to talk about the active participation of the U.S. government in the murdering of Malcolm X, of Martin Luther King, of what was done to Garvey. They don't want to speak about these things. These things are somehow, they're not a part of our history that we should be learning from, because clearly the black liberal and academic class, they're here to actually serve to promote our amnesia.
All right. Yeah. The Scottsboro Boys. I mean, historically, how does that weigh on this case to you? In terms of, we can just, pretty much define these, this young black man any way we want to. We can say he's this. We can say he's that. We can say that he deserved what he got because he was playing live music, because we all know that Africans are thugs, because we can look at Scottsboro Boys case and say, hey, man, they really did what they were accused of. We can look at really hard and say,
we can look at several cases where, that kind of narrative is put forth and not even black people challenge it too tough.
No.
We've actually accepted to a degree. We've accepted this image and we accepted this narrative about ourselves, especially black males. But oftentimes, obviously, with the Duke rape case, we accept it about black women as well. And we generally, as a people, we don't challenge it. We may cry some tears and say some prayers and make a little bit of noise about it, but we're not shutting anything down.
Well, they think they're going to lose their iPhone if they do.
You're right. And I think at this point, it appears with my dealings with black people, it appears that black people we've come full circle where we just don't want white people to think that we're unruly. I deal with so many black people on a daily basis, whether it's in, you know, I guess in the corporate work world or the government work world, you know, where I work sometimes as an IT slave. It just appears to me that, you know, you have a bunch of, a servile black folks who really, they don't even speak too loudly around white folks. And I'm like, wow, we've really come full circle in that sense. And I think Barack Obama has a lot to do with that. I think every time Barack has an opportunity to speak, he basically, you know, he reemphasizes this code of behavior that black people need to adhere to. Even if you get angry, you know, let Barack filter it for you. Let's filter it through Barack. You know, and I think black people have really accepted that, this figurehead is on our side, and if things get too bad, he'll speak to the issue for us. A new understanding of Marion Barry and his understanding of old school black power. And obviously we can talk all day about Marion Barry's personal failings or his personal frailties more so. I saw him after a time of observing living in the DC metro area, that he's someone who understands the corruption of American government and understands the street and gangster origins of American politics, and saw himself as an anti-hero for black people within that structure. And that has given me more of an appreciation, not saying I agree all the time, but more of an appreciation for Marion Barry and his old school understanding of political power.
Well, here's a good paired example. Here you have Tom Ford up in Toronto, Canada. And right. Cocaine, crack, alcoholism. There's even a rumor that he was mentioning putting a hit on somebody or having the ability to put a hit on somebody. And then a drug dealer who was associated with him, he's missing or something like that. Or worse, there's a lot of stuff flying up there, and then you got what's going on with the Harper government, and hey, nothing's being done. You have what happened to the native people who were protesting up there in New Brunswick at LC Potok, and they just basically abused all these people. They brought in more than 1,000 police officers for a town of about 800 people. With all of the military hardware now that they're using over in Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever else, Africa, okay, that's an angle we can go at. Looking at what's happening in Africa, we are now being told that the U.S. Marines are going to be spread out all over the continent.
I did read that last week.
Okay, so black weakness in Africa, how does that translate to black weakness in the United States?
How can you, at this point with the condition of African people in general, you can't really draw a distinction. Obviously, the continent of Africa is being recarved by the old school imperialists, the same parties that carved up Africa, is it 200 years ago, they're carving it up again. But this time, obviously, you can include China. It's interesting. One of the things that I gathered right away when Barack Obama was, I don't say that he was elected. I say he was installed. The reason I say he was installed is because obviously you have a whole capitalist apparatus that was behind him and sold him to American people. And obviously you didn't have to sell Barack Obama to black people. He had black people's votes in the bag. But it was very clear to me. I said to myself, obviously this man being of supposed Kenyan heritage, that they're going to use this man as an ambassador on the continent. He's going to spearhead the recolonization of the continent. And obviously, you know, they obviously a lot of things that are being implemented now started under George Bush, but obviously Barack Obama is putting his special seal on it, and he can obviously because he's got this supposed pedigree that he can use to go into the continent.
Well, how would you define that pedigree in terms of the socio-political power? Well, yeah, I mean, the socio-political power of let's say, you know, the man being the right skin tone, the right height, having the background of a Barack Obama, you know. Remember how they kept saying, well, you know, he's the one, you know, he's the perfect one. And then what I started realizing that a lot of the white folks that I knew, what they were talking about was, is that he's not like you. He doesn't come from a slave background.
Right. I've heard that as well. You know, it's interesting. I've actually heard some of when Barack Obama went to Kenya, some of his connections to some of you know, I guess I don't know if they're distant family members who were also running for political office, that he came in, it seemed to support going to Kenya. I don't know if you caught any of that.
Well, I mean, I know he has a brother that lives in China, and they just met because it was in some African news site I was looking at. They haven't seen each other in 20 years, and it was the photo of them embracing. And I know he has an uncle that lives here, and another uncle that lives there, and an aunt that lives a couple. I mean, you know, there's various things. I don't know which ones are real, which ones are not real. You know, then there's all the speculation about his mother. You know, like we were just talking about, you know, the slave background. Well, I mean, no, his father was a slave to anybody. He was a slave to the British. And, you know, the far right, just the GOP Republicans, you know, the conservatives here, they like to talk about his father's supposed anti-colonial background, which seems to be really more theoretical than any real activism per se. But, I mean, there's rumors that she had two passports at the same time. She was with one man in Indonesia, you know, she was with this African. You know, I mean, he has the kind of a perfect background for somebody who would do overseas work. You know what I mean? And then there's still talk about John Pilger, the Australian writer, has mentioned, and a few other people, that the company that he worked for, Business International, has some shady background. So, you know, when we look at all of that, and then say, look at Malcolm X, who was placed in New York at Temple No. 7 by Elijah Muhammad for the same reasons. You know, how do you break that down? How would you deconstruct that?
Well, I mean, about Barack Obama's background, I think you and I probably read some of the same material. My understanding of Barack Obama is as likely he was groomed for several years. It's my understanding that while he was here in New York, there was some dealing with a company that Henry Kissinger even owned, and many of the people who were supposedly, I guess, in his class at Columbia don't even recall him being there, or don't recall him being there very often. And the fact that it appears that Barack Obama did do some traveling around that time, it makes it appear as if he came out of nowhere, you know. But in a sense, it also seems that he's been groomed for the position. But jumping back, we were talking about in terms of the continent. I mean, obviously, on the continent, you have probably a couple of generations now of colonial African leadership that were installed by previous colonial powers. And I'm sure none of them have any particular problem with Barack Obama. And as we know, with our colonial leadership here in America, they're concerned with image and image alone. And obviously, you know, Barack appearing as a favorite son of prodigal son of Africa, that they have no problem with Barack Obama. I think maybe there are some grumblings now with some of the military incursions into Somalia and Ethiopia. And what is the new AMERICOM? AMERICOM is I guess what this new the Marines being placed all over the continent. That'll be an expansion of AMERICOM. Is that it?
You're talking about AFRICOM, which really it seems to be a return to AFRICOM, because if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong about this, if there's a listener that actually has any concrete information on this, I would really appreciate it. And you can definitely, email us that and anything else you got on your mind is aboriginalradio@gmx.sc. And remember, that's Radio with a Y, right? It's Pinoy Radio. So aboriginalradio@gmx.sc. Anyone who has any real concrete information on this, definitely, forward it to me. But I remember hearing about Eurocom, AFRICOM. You had CETO during Vietnam, right? You have NATO, which is what you and I basically have the consciousness of, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Why is NATO in Africa? When the Mali Mall attack happened, it turns out that there were IDF. There were Israeli troops and some American FBI people that were there hours after that happened. How is that possible? How is this possible?
I'm familiar that there were IDF there.
That's what the British press was saying. So, what is going on? And then we think of Idi Amin, and we think of these people, and then you look at Mugabe and what have you. And you look at the chaos that was going around that time. Look at the Ian Smith government. Who was backing them? How were they being backed? What was happening in Mozambique? Now, I know for a lot of listeners, where am I going with all of this? Right? Because I'm being long-winded anyway. Where am I going with all of this? What I'm trying to say to you, brothers and sisters, is that what happened to Jordan Davis? What happened to Romali Graham? What happened to Oscar Grant, Ayanna Jones, Derrick Jones? Names that we know, right? Sean Bell, Kendrick Johnson, this other brother who missed his organs. And then you got Alfred Wright, missing ear, missing teeth, found him without his clothes. No one really wants to talk about that, even though I know CNN did a special tonight. I haven't seen it yet. But what I'm trying to say is, brothers and sisters, is that, when we look at Malcolm X, he talked about the Bang Dong Conference, and he talked about how, because I'm old enough to remember this, where they would say, you don't have a Chinaman's chance. And that changed after Mao. And then it changed after Mao got more military power. Now, I'm not approving of, very much that Mao did, even though I understand the situation. The Cultural Revolution, we can say what we want to say about it. We can talk about what was going on in the 50s with the move that was made by the West to overturn the Cultural Revolution, and why you see what's going on in Tibet right now, which is not in any way excusing what is going on in Tibet. What is happening in Tibet is the colonial situation. What's happening in Tibet is, the usual Han Chinese ethnic racism that is being used, the xenophobia that is being used against the indigenous people, who are an indigenous people in Tibet, which is not to say that their system was perfect. It was a theocracy. This Dalai Lama is one of the few that's actually lived this long, because they've been attacked. They've been assassinated. The political violence between the three monasteries, the three schools of Buddhist thought in Tibet. People who don't know anything about Buddhism and don't know much about Tibetan history know nothing about this. And they know nothing about the British being there. And they know nothing about the U.S. replacing the British. And that bringing in. But, what I'm trying to say is that Asians in the United States who have dealt with race riots, exclusion in terms of immigration. You had a Japanese man who committed suicide, I believe it was the 1920s. Don't quote me on this, but it was, early part of the 1900s, where he petitioned several times legally to become recognized as a white person so that he could be American. He says, I've raised my children in the United States. They don't know anything about Japan. They don't know anything about the language. All they know is America. All they know is being here. We're white. We're not black. We're not Mexicans, right? He was, you know, basically playing off the racial hierarchies within his own, you know, Japanese culture on why he deserved to be here. And they told him, no, you're yellow. You will never be a white man. That was the actual decision. But the mood against the Japanese changed when they started to get power. Now, this was after Byrd, long after Byrd. So this is a generation of people who don't really know what happens and how the U.S. ended up in Asia to begin with. They don't talk about the Boxer Rebellion. But what I'm trying to say is that when Mao came in, the Communist Party, like him, hate him. The fact that they had military and political power gave the Asian in the United States, when he walked in San Francisco, he walked in, I suppose, New York City and Philly, wherever else in the United States, it gave him some backbone. Because he had something that backed him up. In terms of Africa, we had a brief period of that the mid-60s to the mid-70s. After that, nobody's given a damn about Africa. And, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, and again, I apologize to you and to the listeners, you know, for being long-winded. But, you know, this is what's going through my mind. That, you know, what we're seeing is related to the rest of this colonialist history.
Well, listen, I mean, you have, I mean, obviously, brother, I mean, you can obviously expand that to, you know, the quote, you know, the so-called Arab Spring. I mean, you know, obviously you have, you know, European powers who are, you know, want to basically spin the world into a level of chaos. And I mean, if you go into your continent, you want to make sure that no revolutionary movement is ever going to top off there again. And obviously, you look here in the States, you look at Chicago, places like Chicago, the levels of fratricide going on in Chicago. You want to make sure that, you know, that, you know, one of these street tribes or gangs, as they call them, don't politicize themselves. You want to make sure that there's so much confusion and ignorance that nothing will ever challenge the imperialist powers.
Sorry. Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of the imperialist question, the imperialist question is a bitch, because a lot of folks here, especially if they're somewhat financially stable, I'm not talking about being rich. I'm talking about they know that if they go to work, they're going to get a paycheck, or they're going to get a in these cases, not a paycheck, but a right. You know, there's some kind of wage, you know, involved in them. They're going to starve. You know, they're going to be able to always have housing. It may not be with one, may not always be ideal, but they know that they have these things. Because there's that potential that they could always, you know, it seems to be, especially for folks who haven't had much, when they finally do get something, they seem to be willing to put aside the fact that there's a price tag in terms of morality, in terms of ethics, in terms of your own psychological well-being. When you play with the devil, as they say, you're supposed to use a long spoon. But these folks know that, you know, for all of the rap albums, for all of the iPhones, for all of the other, you know, accoutrements, the tattoos, all of this, you know, attention and money and energy that they're spending on to accumulate all of these things, that these the raw materials are being taken from somebody else someplace who cannot stop the exploitation.
No, without question.
It really becomes then, you know, for you, me, and everybody else, how do we bring up the, you know, even the debate, the conversation on how can we sit here knowing that the more we involve ourselves in this society, the more we begin to lose, the more that we lose our own, you know, self-identity as Africans. As the, you know, people in the diaspora, as people who have suffered and survived not just one but several genocides, you know, when do we start to really say to ourselves enough is enough, and realize that the skin bleaching and the hair cream and the hair straightening and wanting to be either a thug or a musician or a basketball star, that these are really results of colonialism? And even though, having said that, even if we did drop all of that and somehow started wearing dashikis again, would that really be the answer to everything that's, you know, that is facing us, especially when you're looking at groups like the Nation of Islam, who are pure capitalists. They're pure capitalists. Absolutely. I mean, they're talking about getting on Wall Street, not getting away from Wall Street.
Absolutely. You're right. I mean, you have, you know, even as, you know, many white folks that I listen to oftentimes, on a lot of these, you know, the white nationalists, you know, the sovereignty podcasts and forums, what they're talking about the fall of the dollar and the restructuring of capitalism and looking for various countries in Central America to hide out in while the system collapses. But you look at black people, and you know, a lot of Latino and indigenous folks as well, they're talking about jumping in the system, you know, both feet. You know, they seem not to notice that things are falling apart, or don't seem to care as well. You know, so obviously we've been fully indoctrinated. You know, all these you know, colonized folks have been fully indoctrinated with a capitalist ideal system. You know, and also, you know, and this connects also to what you were talking about on the continent. I mean, the continent has obviously a huge issue with the worship of capitalist ideals and European, you know, and I think, you know, it, for me, it's been a tough thing to obviously witness Africans in America who have almost completely abandoned their identity.
Well, I mean, in Africa right now, I'm hearing that they're Chinese, that they don't, well, I'm not going to go so far as to say they don't identify with China anymore, but, you know, these are fellas and some women that have come over to Africa to work for the Chinese companies that operate. And they are eating African food, and they're learning the languages, and they're meeting women, they're meeting men, and they're raising families, and they don't want to go back to China, you know? So you have, you know, in some of those areas, the native people who are associating with them, doing business with them, building relationships, friendships, what have you. There's now, you know, where we've had in Africa for the most part, especially, say, in Francophone Africa, those who wanted to be seen as someone assimilated, they drank beer, they wore arresting suits, they spoke French well. In the East, you had the, you know, I have a German relative. I can tell you about sauerbraten. I drink beer, right? You have those who, where Italy went, espresso, wine, what have you. So now we have China popping up in Africa. So now we have Chinese that are associating with Chinese isms, idioms. How do you think that's going to relay in terms of an analysis on how we are adapting to things? And again, this to me isn't a negative. This is how societies develop. This is how people build kinship and community. I'm not against this. But Africa is in such dire shape, and the African already doesn't have an identity. And the African's already been struck by Western Europeans. And then you have Arabs, in terms of Islam and what have you, that has been brought in, and their role in the slave trade. So now we have Asia. And when I'm not talking about India, I'm not talking about South Asia, where we have a direct connection, even though we don't really discuss it that much. Now we're talking about, you know, greater Asia. How do you think this is going to work out in terms of what is happening with AFRICOM, what is happening with the French and the Belgians trying to get, well, actually, they're not trying to get back in, they're in. The Israelis, who were in with Idi Amin in South Africa and the Rhodesian government, now they're back in.
I guess we can jump into the meat of it. If, you know, one of the things that John Henry Clark said not too long before he, you know, made his transition was that that the African should keep his eye on the Asian. He said that the Asians are a people looking for their peopleness, and that when the Asian comes into Africa, they are going to eat the African out of house and home. Now, I tend to agree with that to a certain extent, but I think that that can be turned around if we're smart. And I say we because I think of I'm talking about the global African. And this actually leads me to my next point. In order for the African on the continent to survive, we must bridge the gap between the greater African family. The African in the Americas has to bridge the gap with the African on the continent, or neither of us will survive. Mm. Neither of us will survive, because that's what we're witnessing. We're witnessing the final decline of the African. And if we don't bridge that gap, we're done. We're all done. But in terms of the Chinese, I think that, listen, genetically, it is a fact. The closest relation that the Chinese person has is the African. That's a genetic fact. I don't know if you're aware of that, brother.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you're a black man, you know, I've read The Son of Man, you know.
Yeah,
I'm down with my 1-20, man. I may not, you know, talk like it, but yeah, yeah.
Okay, I got you. Well, the fact of the matter is, the darkest people on the face of this earth are in Asia, not in Africa.
Yeah.
No, and that's just a fact. The incursion of the Chinese into Africa can be used to our benefit. Obviously, they are building tremendous infrastructure. That infrastructure can be nationalized at some point. But what needs to be done is done. If we can find our way back to a pan-Africanist, a revolutionary, possibly a revolutionary socialist mindset, that can be used to our benefit.
Well, I mean, that's okay. That's a question I can ask you. The socialism aspect, you know, most people who are African do not understand socialism. They've heard about it, but they don't know what it is. They've heard about communism, but they don't know what that is either. Indigenism. Right. Nobody else has heard of that outside of South America. And, you know, most people who are not indigenous don't want to talk about it, even though it relates to what's going on in Africa. Many people who consider themselves indigenous, like myself, consider Malcolm X to be an indigenous theorist. Yes, he was born in the United States, but he also recognized Africa as the birthplace of man. So if you are an African, you are technically an indigenous person, even though in Africa, that is another distinction, which is something we need to raise too, because we have indigenous people that are completely being wiped out by, you know, in some cases by neglect in terms of the Khoisan people, and in other places, like say in Botswana, where it's direct and it's being done by black people who do not consider themselves to be indigenous. They don't consider themselves to be tribal. They consider themselves to be Francophone or Germanic, right? Or Arab. And now, you know, we're increasingly, you know, hearing about Chinese. You know, where is that going to go in terms of our future anywhere in the diaspora? Because when I try to talk to people about homophobia, there's this whole thing about, oh, well, you know, we got to stop the gays, man, because they're trying to take over Africa and what have you. And it's like, wait a minute. Every anti-gay law anywhere the Europeans have gone was put on by Europeans. We haven't even discussed the African paradigm on sexuality yet. Mostly because a lot of us don't want to go there, because now we're talking about Vodun, but because of horror films like White Zombie and the other cultural propaganda against Africans in the motherland, in the Americas, in the Caribbean especially, where these things became, Vodun, Voodoo, Blé, right? You know, Pakwa, you know, all of these various, isms, hoodoo here in Gullah land, right? I mean, with the Gullah, I mean, there was a specific spiritual tradition that is unique to the Gullah people, period. But we're not able to connect these things. And it seems that when some of us do try to connect these things, in the 70s or in the 60s, you might have been told if you took the perm out of your hair, oh, you look like, you know, which was an insult.
Right.
Now, right? You know, now it's like, I just watched with my wife, House of Joy. We watched it online. And I'm going to tell you something, man. You know, it was hard for me to sit through because in the very first episode, it's this brother. It's one of these reality shows. And what it turns out is, you know, one of the first things this cat says in the first episode was, now, I love my indigenous sisters. I don't care if they speak English or Spanish. But it's the way that he said it. When you have black women out here who are complaining about being ignored, and then they got to put up with something like Rick Ross, you know, or you know, any of these other clowns that are out here calling themselves rappers. And the first thing he said was, man, she was light-skinned and bright, man. You see her? I wanted that, man. You know, and again, I'm not knocking him because I've done this myself. You hook up with somebody, you know, you eat their food. I mean, if you're really with them any goddamn way, you eat their food. You know, you get into their culture. All right. He eats is Mexican food now, right? You know, that's all he's dealing with. I mean, he still does his music thing. But it's how he said it. It's what he said. The fact that we don't even want to deal with each other anymore. And when we do deal with other people of color, I'd rather be with an Asian than with another African. I'd rather be with a Latino, which I hate that term, but we're going to use it. I'd rather be with a Latino rather than an African. I'd rather be with anybody. I'd rather be with somebody half black than somebody black. And then, you know, when I look at the Dunn trial, and it's like, well, this could happen because socially we're not together. Politically, we're not together. Economically, we're not together. We're not even on the same page, like, as you've mentioned earlier, on whether or not a black man should or should not be shot because somebody's afraid of him. You know, I keep trying to explain to folks, man, you know, majority of brothers that are sent, you know, who are sent up by predominantly black juries. Who feel
not
that...
Not surprising.
Well, you know, they feel that I don't want to be robbed. I go and I work for my money. I do my 40, 45 hours a week. These guys right here robbing people. They're not asking why did the community is in the shape that it's in. They're not asking any economic questions. They're not asking any political questions. They're not asking any psychological questions on the damage that, you know, this population has gone through, their own population. Because the idea
You're absolutely
is,
right.
You know, and it's hard to really say that people are being selfish. But you ask yourself, if you've been scrounging for so much and then you have a chance or maybe possibly if you get lucky, you know, like a lottery ticket, that you'll somehow move up and move up in the game. How do we politically work, you know, as my final question, how do we politically work against that and try to turn the tide on where we were in the 70s, taking into account COINTELPRO and all of that? You know, how do we roll about where, you know, we start to realize that wearing a dashiki doesn't necessarily make you a nigga, but at the same time, wearing that business suit doesn't mean that you're accepted by the white, you know, power structure either.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As you were talking, brother, I was thinking about, I'm trying to remember their name. I came across this group on Facebook, and they're a group of conservative black folks, and I believe they are the African American Rifle Association. I don't want to get that right, but I just came across them. And, you know, I've gotten into a couple of exchanges with, I guess, their administrator. And they seem to be a group of former military police officers. It seems like most of them are retired. And, you know, and I keep broaching very similar to what you just said. I keep coming at them with that, trying to explain to them, like, listen, because very clearly they are the kinds of black people that you talk about that would be on the juries that would be convicting a lot of these young brothers and who may or may not, you know, agree with the verdict that came down today. They don't seem to feel like they have any connection to the poor and black underclass. You know, and I think many of these people, these conservative black folks, are not very old. you know, obviously some of them are probably in their 60s, but some of them are probably in their 40s, you know, and used to be running the streets as young people probably not too long ago. But again, as we were talking about earlier, what happens when people actually, you know, take on the ideals of the dominant the dominant power? And that's what's happened in the Black community. We've actually accepted the ideals of European Americans as our own. So we don't even look at it. We don't even look at each other's with an affinity anymore. You know, we're actually seeing ourselves through the eyes of Europeans.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we always have, to some degree, once we accept.
To a degree, right.
Well, what I mean, politically speaking, once we accepted the concept that they have power over us, they, you know, this person can change my life, they can control, you know, basically what happens to me. And, you know, military force has a lot to do with that, and also the power of the church. Power of language.
Church is a big component.
And like when I'm talking about, you know, what's going on now with these American, white American missionaries going into Africa and turning people. First, it was witches. Now it's gay people. And, you know, there are a lot of brothers who don't even want to talk to me about this. And I'm like, you got to understand something, brother. If you understood your own background as a West African, Vodun does not discriminate, you know, in terms of sexual orientation. That's one thing. Second thing, most of the priests, most of the people who are considered, you know, the clerics in organ are generally not heterosexual. For lack of a better term, many are cross-gender. If you look at the actual deities, in which there's, what, 2,000 plus one, right? That's the old joke, because there's so many. Many of them are of, you know, bi-gender. Yeah, I don't know how else to put it. Transgender, or what have you. Or have the ability to morph into one gender or the next. I mean, many indigenous beliefs have this. And then you have what are called two-spirit people here in the Native American tradition in North America.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I mean, Africa also has this pattern. But, you know, the Europeans came and it was wiped out. The knowledge of this is wiped out. Now, it exists in Vodun. But, you know, that concept of, say, if we really want to deal on a strictly sexual level, is not the Western European concept of homosexuality. The Asian classical Chinese, for one example, view of homosexuality is very different. I'm not saying that it's good or that it's bad. It's different. There was a role,
you know,
for people.
What's interesting about what you're talking about, and I've had this conversation with comrades as well. You know, we've gotten into very deep conversations about. You know, the dominant, we just say European culture, and that's the same in America, in terms of sexuality and sexual orientation. You know, I don't know if you caught it recently. The protests in France, the pro-family protests against gay marriage and so on and so forth. Have you caught that?
Yeah, well, I caught some of it. I mean, there's a lot of that going on, especially with the Sochi Olympics, so it's in the news. Right.
Right. Exactly. So what's interesting is that, you know, obviously you've had Barack Obama comment on some of the anti-gay laws on the African continent and pressuring certain states about their laws. And, you know, to a degree, obviously completely understandable, ridiculous laws, you know, that basically outlawing human beings and basically targeting them for extermination. It's pretty ridiculous shit. But we, you know, but it was really interesting that Barack Obama didn't make any statements to these European states that were having these very large protests, you know, and so obviously for African people and African and indigenous people, when we see that kind of stuff, it becomes very suspect. You know, and so when you have this very heavy-handed, when people perceive this very heavy-handed, and I when I say liberal, I use liberalism in basically as synonymous with Western culture. And they see this very heavy-handed liberal Western culture being pushed and promoted and actually redefining and redesigning, you know, the relationship between men and women, and not just, I mean, not just sexual orientation, but actual relationships being redefined between, you know, who is who actually has the role of providing for the family and, you know, who actually heads the household and so on and so forth. And we can obviously get into the conversation around, you know, around misogyny and around, you know, these and around women and chauvinism. But the African indigenous people, we haven't decided, we haven't had these conversations. We need to have these conversations for ourselves and haven't had the opportunity to do that. And not that it looks like that we will be able to have this conversation when people are actually basically in a battle for their own survival. It doesn't seem that we'll be able to have these intellectual, you know, study groups to be able to make our way through these discussions. But you understand, I mean, I'm speaking to the fear. The fear is, I don't think the fear is just in, obviously, you have an element in every population that is reactionary, that is hateful, and they, you know, anything that is different, they want to beat it with a rock. But if you connect the fear of just being wiped out in general, connecting it with, you know, alongside with the redefinitions of male-female relations and also sexual orientation, it just seems like a mountain is being moved on top of you, bro.
Yeah, I mean, this is a psychological weight that is really disturbing, you know, and Fanon has written about this. Derrida has written about this. Jean-Paul Sartre has written about this in terms of Algeria and Indochina. Well, they all have, really, in terms of Indochina and what have you. But yeah, man, you know, I mean, we can talk about this for hours, and, you know, I do appreciate your staying as long as you have. You know, Brother Malachi Daniels, you can check him out on at Fanonian. You will definitely see him in my timeline. You know, I really want you to see what he's saying, what he's thinking, and you know, what do you have coming up next, bro?
Well, you know, honestly, brother, I've been, you know, between trying to work my way through this, you know, having to work on the plantation myself. Actually been trying to reach out to graffiti artists in New York City and also grassroots organizations and actually individuals as well to actually attack some of, I guess, you know, what people speak of as gentrification, but I call population displacement, and trying to get a decolonized collective going here in New York City. Yeah, well, in tackling some of the issues in the city, I mean, of having a new and largely affluent white population that has basically redrawn the lines in the city, whether that be racial and economic, whether it be the lines of happening within you know, rezoning neighborhoods and so on and so forth, and we have a city that is actually being turned into a very modern example of apartheid, and it's, you know, it people are being slow boiled in it. You know, I've talked to other activists who, because they have white comrades, say they don't necessarily see it, and then I talk to poor black folks and Latino folks, and they say they see it very clearly. So it also makes me suspect of a lot of my comrades who have become very careerist in their activism. You know, many of them have been working in the not-for-profit industry for too long, I think. I think they've lost touch a lot of times with the people on the street who see these things happening, and but don't necessarily have the tools or the analysis to attack it.
Then we think about Renisha McBride, and right, then Kendrick Johnson. And these are just the recent ones. You know, we're not talking about, you know, a few years ago, 10 years ago. We're talking about recent things. I don't know where else we can, you know, conceivably go with this other than the hope that those of you who have, you know, taken part in this conversation with Brother Daniels and I, that you do raise your intellects, man, to start talking about this. You know, you have a right to free speech. You know, I mean, we got black men that are going on television demanding a right to call themselves and other black men niggas. Matter of fact, I get into arguments all the time, it seems. I mean, I seem to always have a disagreement with a black person who feels that it's okay for white people to use nigga. Faggot is wrong, but nigga is okay. You know, and, you know, it's a really difficult thing to explain to somebody that, you know, or really get them to at least consider that the world that they think that they're living in isn't what they're living in. And then to make things worse is that they know that this isn't the world that they're living in, but they're going along with the dude. And being black in America right now is like being a black male in America right now, it's like having a target on your back.
Did you hear the quote from Michael Dunn's attorney that he said after the verdict was read, that he turned to his attorney and he said, "How could this happen?"
Yeah, I heard.
He seemed to be in a bit of shock that even the three counts that he got shouldn't have happened.
No, because he really didn't think that he did anything wrong. You know,
right, exactly.
He really didn't believe that he did anything wrong. Well, actually, let me correct myself here, because see, this is where I was going on my other spiel, because we know 9 times out of 10 that when we're doing something, we have an idea of what the effect is going to be. Now, people who are really dangerous are the ones who really don't give a damn about how their actions affect other people or situations. But let's just, you know, be clear. Zimmerman knew that what he was doing was wrong. He was told not to engage, and he went in because he wanted a commission. This man was going to drive off anyway, obviously. They didn't get out of the vehicle. They were, you know, I mean, if you want to give him the benefit of the doubt, these were 4 black men who were like, "Oh man, fuck you," and they were rude. And you know, he just, you know, from what I get from this, he just basically didn't like it. You know, it's not so much he felt threatened; he didn't like it. I mean, I saw something on Tumblr earlier today, or perhaps it was Twitter. No, it was Twitter earlier today, and it's in my timeline. I don't know where this quote came from. You can look at the person or the account that actually tweeted it first. But supposedly, the retired police officer that shot a man who was texting in a movie theater during the previews, the main showing hadn't even started yet. He was basically calling his babysitter to make a check on his home.
Right. I remember this.
Well, supposedly, he is saying that the retired cop, the one who went out to his vehicle and came back in the theater to do the damage, supposedly, he is saying, or his defense lawyer is saying, that he thought that the man that he shot was black.
That I didn't hear.
Now, I think that the man had curly hair. When I first read the story and I saw some personal photographs of him, I believe he had curly hair. So what I'm saying is that basically, if this story is true, if what I saw on Twitter is true, and like I said, I retweeted it without knowing the source, but because I felt that it needed to be out there, that this defense lawyer is trying to excuse or mitigate what this retired police officer did in a movie theater because somebody was texting. Turned out to be a white person that he shot. He said that he thought that the person was black. You know, if this story is true, how does this relate to what we are seeing with the Dunn trial, what we saw with the Zimmerman trial? We have other trials that are coming up, you know, on Stand Your Ground cases like this. You know, how, you know, because he saw this man in the dark, and because he couldn't discern, he immediately figured that this was a black male. So he got up and went to his vehicle outside of the movie theater, came back into the theater, and then did what he did.
Well, what I was thinking while you were talking, I was remembering George Zimmerman, some of the video that was shown initially of right after he killed Trayvon Martin, him being taken back to the police station and, you know, spending some time there, you know, obviously being questioned. But during the video, he didn't appear as someone who was a suspect or a perpetrator of a murder. He seemed to appear to me in the video as someone that the police officers were treating as a peer. And thinking about, then I started thinking about Michael Dunn, and how many conversations do you think that Michael Dunn has had in private with other white men, with other white women, about black youth, about Trayvon Martin? And how many times do you think he's had his beliefs co-signed by other people who, you know, other middle class, working class, and poor white people who agreed with his views? So, you know, on a level, men like this believe that they're actually serving, you know, they're actually serving society. They're serving a purpose. Like this individual in the movie theater, who's obviously, and also he's a former paramilitary pig, goes out to his car to come back in to dispatch the problem. Because this is the common belief system of this is, I mean, obviously, you know, there are a great deal of American folks, white folks who don't feel this way. I'll definitely give you that. But obviously, this is the common view of young African men in America, in that young African men are the problem. You know, they are, you know, they are the problem that needs to be dealt with. I don't mean this in a reactionary sense, but obviously it is really time for Africans in America to start considering responsibly training with firearms to protect your community. Because obviously you have an element in America that sees the entire black community, and especially young black men, as a force, you know, an enemy force, enemy element within society. You know, and quite often you have in New York City and other inner city neighborhoods, you have these give back programs and buy back programs where the police department will come into a community and tell the black community to, you know, give up your firearms, basically, you know, and that's basically the same thing that they did to indigenous folks. You know, the war is over. You've lost. Give up your firearms.
Yeah, but see, you know, we can talk about that, too, because I wrote a piece that got some mention in the Boulder Weekly last year, because there was a billboard that was put up in Boulder, Colorado, of three Native men, where the caption read to the effect of, "They took their guns and you see what happened to them." Now, what I bring it up was that because Roy Churchill and I, now I've been accused, you know, of being, you know, which is complete nonsense. I mean, I've actually met the man, and I mean, we talked amicably for about 4 or 5 minutes. I mean, it wasn't anything major, but he has been, you know, heavily criticized for his particular views. And I agree with, you know, the base of them, you know, for the most part. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, stuff that's floating around about him. But the thing about it is, it's hard to knock his analysis of colonialism, despite whatever else is being said about him, which may or may not be true. Anyone who's ever been educated by, you know, by him seems to find him to be very deep and critical with his analysis. And he and I disagreed with this because the reporter who asked him for a statement, he gave him one sentence and basically said he had no problem with it at all, that it basically, you know, made the point, which on the face of it, if it was put out by a Native group who was pro-gun, even though I disagree with this whole pro-gun, pro-gun lobby, just like, you know, with the men's movement, quote unquote, whatever that's supposed to be, I don't want anything to do with them. Now, they raise valid points, but, you know, I mean, the Klan talks about, you know, doing community improvement too, you know, and better schools. That doesn't mean I agree with their platform or want anything to do with their platform. But the difference between Walt Churchill and I was is that he said, oh, I have no problem with this. And I'm like, wait a minute. You know, this is Walt Churchill. You're not looking any deeper into this. Why would the National Rifle Association, which is behind ALEC, behind the John Birch Society, was behind the conservative Christian clubs down in the South and all these groups that were basically Klan fronts that were okay with, you know, gun rights, like, say, in California under Reagan until the Black Panthers started to gear up. Then all of a sudden it wasn't cool anymore. And I'm sorry if I'm going on a tangent, but what I'm trying to get to is even somebody like Walt Churchill, who is a seasoned veteran activist, a veteran analyst, even he did not really, you know, challenge the fact that the gun rights movement would take what happened to indigenous people and then turn around and say, oh, well, look at what happened to them. We're the people that did it. We're the people that continue to do it, which is something that is amazing. Always in Walt Churchill's work. But in this case, he didn't say anything, you know, and then we have what you're talking about, where we have white people who have wiped out Native folks and do everything possible to keep Native people, you know, under thumb, underfoot, and deprived, and then turn around and use their example as a rationale for why they should be allowed to maintain their stashes, their arms, their unlimited amounts of basically where they want to, you know, have a magazine that can go on forever, that they have an American right to have these assault weapons, that they have a right to go shopping at a Safeway or a Key Food or what have you, or an Albertsons with these machines of war. You know, I'm sorry I'm being long-winded, but where I'm going with this is, where I'm trying to go with this is, and I know we were supposed to have ended earlier, but when we have situations where conservatives, and I just brought that up, but there are other, you know, instances where white people will say, well, I feel the way the Indians felt when Obama was elected, saying that they felt the way Indians felt when white people came. What sort of mindset could look at any of this, you know, as if it makes any sense? You know, like these statements from Sarah Palin, you know, that make look at her is another one. She talks about pro-America, pro-Christian, pro this, that, and the other, but her and her husband belong to a separatist group. And people knew this in the Republican Party, and they were still willing to vote for her anyway. And then she turned around and couldn't even finish her term as governor. This is the mindset that allowed for the Dunn trial. And I suppose I'm trying to ask you here, again, as a real final question, is that when we are in a position where we have our own history being used against us to the point where, like I've mentioned this on the show before, where it is easier to find Black and Native American and Latino students in the United States, university and at the college level, who will argue more in favor for Zionism than they will for, say, Black men in America to be free from police brutality. So, you know, where do we go from here?
You know, brother, I think about quite often. How do you, because like you said, most of the youth that I encounter, one of the things that disturb me the most about them is their lack of empathy for homeless people. That's which for me speaks volumes. If you can't find any level of empathy for someone who has nothing, we're really starting off on a back foot. And quite obviously, when you talk to the average Black, Latino, you know, maybe possibly the Asian youth, a political organization is the furthest thing from their mind. Where we go, you know, it doesn't seem that we'll be taking the gadgets away anytime soon from any of us. Awesome. I think has become, like television, a huge weapon of political control. It seems to be relieving people of what's left of their humanity.
Hey, man, I'm seeing people who don't have a pot to piss in who have iPhones.
Right.
Who have smartphones. And when I say to them, you can be tracked now. You're talking about the Illuminati all day long. Now they know where you are, what you're saying, who you're with. They can see even who you're with. Oh, man, man, you know, what's wrong with you, man? You just mad because you don't have one. I admit, I do not have an iPhone. I can't afford it. Even if I could, I don't know if I'd want one, you know. I mean, I have a cell phone out of necessity, but that's about it, you know. It's like a Philip K. Dick novel. You know, we're just continuing to move forward into the hellfire. Right, we can use some of that symbolism, which is something else we can talk about. Real hurt. Here you have all of this stuff going on, the black church, blah, 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 doesn't say anything. With the apocalyptic mindset that's going around now, with the vampires, with the zombies, with the games that, you know, if they're not dealing with dead people, then they're terrorists who are usually not white. How does this weigh in on brothers like Jordan Davis, Kendrick Johnson, Alfred Wright, any of these brothers and sisters, for that matter, who are really just that there's no protection for them, that there's no structure to support them. When we have a culture that's actually pumping out material like this, we have the Hunger Games, and then we have what happened here in all this controversy about the gay issue, which it is an important issue. It's not, I don't think, the most important issue, but it's an important issue here at the Sochi Games. And then it's hard for me to look at the Hunger Games and look at the Olympics and not see that this is the same thing. It's morphed into this. And then we look at all these films, and it seems to be that, you know, we're all being set up for this. So this is really the final one. When we mention the cell phones, when we mention the fact that you and I are over Skype and that this is being listened to and collated someplace.
Right.
How much further is the black man going to continue to just drift like this before he realizes that the ovens are hot and that by this time it's too late?
I'm sure you've given this a lot of thought as well, brother. I think we're at a point where we are about to lose a tremendous amount of a portion of the population of black people. And I think that will be either as a result of a economic, what I always called an economic Katrina. And obviously what would follow after that would be a massive militaristic and police containment. I think on par with some of the things that we've seen in what I call the criminal communist regimes of the past. I hope that doesn't sound like too much far-fetched dystopian conspiracy theory, but it's something that I guess those of us who study history, I think we see a lot of that in America today. I think the radical left is going to have to adopt a tactic that is usually used by religious proselytizers. One of the things that I have always respected about people like Farrakhan is that Farrakhan will go into a community and he will tell that community what their weaknesses are. And generally, the community reacts to that. And what the radical left hasn't done is that it constantly criticizes the capitalists, the imperialists and the oppressors, colonizer, but it doesn't criticize the character and the weaknesses of the people. And the people don't respect that because the people know that they got character flaws. They're looking for someone to provide them with a discipline that can pull them of their morass. And that is what the revolutionary left that I hope is going to rise up soon is going to have to do with the masses, because the masses have become zombies. All this technology and all of this ridiculous reality television has put the entire population to sleep. And the only way that you'll be able to wake them up is you're going to have to jar them with their reality. That's my opinion on it.
Okay, well, because of what you said, I have to ask you, because I've, you know, criticized Minister Farrakhan and the leadership of a certain political group in Florida about this.
I have as well.
I like their work. And their organization is some of the best I've seen in a long time. But the idea that, you know, of a single, solid, stoic leader, Marcus Garvey, made that mistake, I feel.
Mm.
People tried to do that. Garvey did it himself in Zimbabwe, and I find that limiting. It was done to...
Are you talking about Amalia Chitella?
Well, yeah, if we're going to name names, you know.
Okay.
It's just the idea. Well, I don't want to talk about any behind anybody's back either, but, you know, there's a... What I'm saying is there's already a controversy going on between that organization and another organization.
Right. And, right, exactly.
And, you know, I don't know if it's really them or if it's Cointo Pro 2 or you know, what's going on. But and I'm not a member of either, so I'm just reading both of their news reports and staying neutral about it.
Right.
We've had one of them on the show before when Troy Davis, or at least that week that Troy Davis was executed. We had him on. We talked about that. But, you know, basically, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not comfortable with any movement that believes that, you know, there needs to be an Ayatollah.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you. I love the politics of the African People's Socialist Party. I love their political line. I love Uhuru. I've actually worked with Uhuru in Atlanta before. But the things that disturbed me were some of the things that you just mentioned. Those are some of the things that whenever I go to a function of the African People's Socialist Party, I have to say that what appears to be a sort of deification of Amalia Chitella does disturb me at times.
Yeah, I mean, that's my whole thing, because, you know, I listen to their radio on a regular basis, and it's good activist radio. I implore everybody to check out uhuraradio.com on a regular basis, to check out their news feeds and whatever. You know, it's a good resource. But, you know...
Yeah, I love their political line. I think they have the strongest political line of any organization in this country right now.
I agree with you. I agree. I've seen black people be disorganized on a politicized level since the 70s, you know, since, you know, I was young. I just haven't seen it. And they got it. Well, because he comes from that school and he's able to give them that sort of leadership. And he also, I'm assuming, is conscious of what you were talking about. But see, let's say that this particular brother doesn't let the power go to his head. But he's still been deified. So when he, you know, when there's that vacuum, then what? We've seen what happens in power vacuums. We can look at Libya as a quick example of a power vacuum. You know, Iraq is another good example. You know, Afghanistan never really had any centralized power. So, you know, the fact that they're trying to centralize it is making things even more chaotic. But, you know, one of the things, and I know we're going on a little longer than, again, that was planned, but if we're going to mention names or talk about situations, I just recently saw the film Crips and Bloods with my wife, and it was disturbing me on a political level because, yeah, I've seen this before and I've heard it before and such and so on, and I've seen what I've seen. Okay. But somebody lying in that film that I had said one time in analysis that I wish that I had written down, but he said it on film during this documentary, that if the war going on between the Crips and the Bloods, if that had been in Ireland, in Poland, in Russia, in Chile, it would have been called a civil war.
Right.
But in this case, it's just niggas killing niggas. So we're not going to really, you know, really condemn that. Now, a lot of folks have always tried to ask themselves, where did this come from? Now, in terms of the Crips, the original Crips, Tookie Williams, who was gone now, who founded the Crips, that was supposed to be an offshoot, a piggybacking of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, after they were removed from the scene.
I'm familiar.
right? After COINTELPRO, you know, pretty much dismantled that, right? And we see Daruba Bin Wahad, we see Geronimo Pratt, we see a lot of people like Albert Woodfox, right? Who's still in there, you know, they just released Brother Not, you know, like, what, 3 days before he passed? You know, basically, the warden said it. It's because they're Panthers, not for even what they were accused of. It's because they're Black Panthers. They belong to a radical group. Whereas you have Klansmen who are prison guards in state and private facilities, institutions, who openly belong to racist organizations. Police officers that openly belong to racist organizations. Wasn't there supposedly a white supremacist organization in the same station that was investigating O.J. Simpson case?
I do recall that.
That Furman and Van Adder, those two, that they were supposed to be a part of this? Because I remember Judge Ito's wife, who was the captain of that precinct, which is already a conflict of interest. How are you going to have the husband of the captain that is investigating the case also judge the case? But you and I both know why Judge Ito was a particular situation. Because in the American eye, in the mainstream white view that we all are going through, he was neutral, right? If a white judge came in and Simpson was convicted, well, he convicted Simpson because he was Black. If he didn't, and it was a white judge, well, they say, well, he was trying to appease the Black community, trying to prevent a race riot. If it was a Black judge and Simpson was freed, oh, well, he helped free him because they're Black and they all work together, which you and I both know is a lie. And if he was convicted under him, well, he had to prove to the white society that he could, you know, come down just as hard on him as he would as on anybody else. But if you get a Latino, well, the idea is that they tend to side Black people, which is not necessarily true, but this is the belief. Yeah, I mean, this is what we heard during the Soy Matar, if that's how you pronounce the name, the only Latina, the only Indian that's been on the Supreme Court. And I'm surprised the Native Americans have not talked about that. They have not recognized that a Taino from Puerto Rico has become technically the first Native American, as far as I'm aware anyway, on the Supreme Court. I haven't heard anything about that. I didn't hear anything.
I think sometimes that comes from the, you know, but I often say to my Boricua brothers and sisters, I'm like, hey, you know, you don't forget that you're indigenous too. And I think a lot of times our Latino brothers and sisters, they claim in their Spanish heritage more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're not talking about that. And they kept bringing up her supposedly activist record. But when if you look at, you know, the time that she's been on the bench, she's voted more than 60, but what, more than that? She's overwhelmingly voted on the side of corporations. She's overwhelmingly voted against labor and so on. You know, she's not really up there helping public. But that's like saying that Clarence Thomas, who is Geechee, who really didn't speak, regular English, regular, you know, American English until he was about 16, 17, you know, he only spoke Gullah. What has he done for Black folks? You know, and like I said, what was Colin Powell doing when he was in office, you know, besides lying at the UN? I mean, Condoleezza Rice was buying shoes during the Katrina crisis. You know, and I don't know, you know, I mean, I had a point and we're going on all these tangents, but, you know, and like I said, I apologize to you and the listeners for that. But, you know, it's really a trip. I mean, if we had had one of these conversations by the usual concision, okay, 5 minutes and then we take a break, right? You know. And then we come back and so on. It all ends up sounding the same. And everything that brother and I here have talked about, I mean, you tell me, ladies and gentlemen, Aboriginal Radio with a Y at gmx.sc. You tell me if you heard the concepts and the thought and analysis, you know, that you've heard here, to, you know, whenever you're listening to this, today, this afternoon, this evening. Tomorrow, this is On Demand Radio. You know, when do you hear this on CNN? When do you hear this on BET? You know, when are they really talking about this? I can't, you know, say this enough. If you're not going to the independent media, you know, other than I talking about the Uhuru movement, check their media. You want to find out what's going on in Africa? Check their media. Their analysis is good. You know, but I say again, you know, I'm not particularly comfortable with any political movement that is, you know, one person is making decisions for everybody. You know, I'm not into cults. things because, you know, even if they don't start out that way, this was what ends up happening. I mean, technically, we want to end this on a religious tip, right? Because, you know, people are always, you know, not particularly happy with my view on Christianity. Well, hey, you know, one thing that Omali Yeshiti, he was talking about, and we got the audio for this, and we should probably replay it at the end of this this talk. You know, if Jesus was such a revolutionary, why is your preacher such an Uncle Tom?
I've heard that.
You know, I mean, Jesus Christ told the Romans to get out, right? He said, fight them. He said, hey, it's the Sabbath. What are you doing hoeing in the church and in the temple and doing business on, you know, on the Sabbath? You know, what the hell's going on? You know, he was everything that today he would be put on the list. He certainly wouldn't be allowed to fly. You know, I mean, he would be monitored, right? There would be files on him in a bunch of different places with a bunch of different agencies and organizations. You know, I mean, you can't talk about Jesus, the Christos, right? And then, you know, talk about what the hell is going on, because we had a political movement of indigenous Jews, if you want to take it that far, right? I mean, if you want to ignore Exodus and look at the Jewish community there as indigenous to the territory. For the sake of argument, so that we don't offend anybody, we'll go with that right now, for argument's sake. But, you know, he was, you know, a totally anti-imperialist leader who was turned in by the Uncle Toms of his own society, you know. So, you know, when we talk about what's going on, with whether it's the Dunn trial or whether it's AFRICOM in Africa, because, you know, when we take it all in, we have to look at, you know, if we take the Christ story, well, you know, the Jesus the Christ story, anyway, the Christ. If we take that story and remove the religious and spiritual aspects from it, and as a political revolutionary in Roman-occupied territory, on the easternmost part of the realm, right? You have to then ask yourself, politically speaking, what would be good about having one person venerated that much to it becomes a religion, it becomes a faith, it becomes, as you mentioned, John Henry Clark, you know, the Honorable John, Dr. John Henry Clark, who made it very clear that we've never really learned in the United States as black people how to bury the man and carry on the plan. That when we've lost leadership, that was it. You know, everything folded. We didn't know what to do. Now, yeah, I mean, in terms of the Black Panther Party for self-defense, you know, rightly or wrongly, you then had the Black Liberation Army, right? We talk about the Irish Republican Army. Well, you know, a lot of people don't really understand that there was this. I mean, COINTELPRO did away with it. And I'm not agreeing or saying that what they were doing was particularly good. I mean, Russell Maroon Schultz is one of the people, another man who's been in solitary confinement for how long now, bro?
I believe down almost 30 years, is it?
Yeah, something like that, 3 decades. You know, and he said, you know, we took on a militant stance way too early. Because, you know, they got caught up in what Mao was doing, got caught up in Cuba, got caught up in Algeria, you know, what have you. And, you know, felt that if they, geared up, that somehow this was going to bring, you know, revolution. And that wasn't exactly what was happening. You know, and they didn't have the maturity at the time to see that, even though we know now from the late Geronimo Pratt that they were a group of elders, basically the Deacons for Defense, that was coordinating a response. But it wasn't a necessarily armed response. You know, and from what I understand, the only thing in terms of a response was really self-defense. You know, not what, you know, I mean, it was just totally different tip, you know, the whole New African movement. And same thing with the American Indian movement. You know, I mean, you have to actually really do the research and try to find out what the hell was really going on with the, you know, with these movements and the time surrounding them. And now that I've mentioned AIM, and because somebody passed away, and this is really the final thing I'm going to mention. And for the listeners, I think it relates to the Dunn trial, but you tell me how it relates to the Dunn trial, or if you think that it doesn't relate to the Dunn trial. When the American Indian Movement had their sit down in Wounded Knee in 1973, there was a black activist named Ray Robinson Jr. who had worked with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in the South. You're talking about a trained, committed activist. Well, he disappeared in Wounded Knee in 1973, and no one has ever discussed what happened to him. Now, Carter Camp, who was present at Wounded Knee, one of the original AIM members, dedicated warrior, Indian, passed away from cancer, believe it was last week. He supposedly told the, I don't know if it was the press or if it was the authorities, that he didn't get along with people at the camp, Ray Robinson. And he was known for being confrontational now, but that he wasn't getting along with people at the camp or whatever. Various stories have come around or have been expressed that he refused to take up arms, right? Because, you know, he was up in violent training, the nonviolent philosophy of King, as he was relating it through his study of Gandhi, Krishnamurti. Whatever the case is, he disappeared. His body was never found. And that's pretty much been the end of it. Now, Carter Camp just passed away recently. And like I said, he made a statement claiming that this man walked away, which means that he had contact with the man. Now, I don't want to speak ill of the dead. And this is a situation I've brought up on this show a couple of times. But let me ask you real quick, brother. In terms of our relations with Native Americans, in terms of racism, I'm not going to make the argument right now because I can't say if the racism per se is necessarily, because I mean, Plains Indians deal with African people in a different way. West Coast, coastals, like, you know, Lumi, Duwamish nations I mentioned earlier, their relationship with Africans was different. The East Coast is a completely different situation. You go to some nations, everybody is black, right? For all kinds of purposes.
Right.
To just look at
right.
Shinnecocks, what have you, right? All along the Eastern Seaboard. All the way down to Florida. So when we look at how a black man could disappear during a Native American struggle for independence, and that no questions have been raised in the Native community, much less the white community, and remember, the Native community is still also dealing with Anamaya Quash. What happened with her? We don't really know. You know, what I'm trying to say is, you know, movements for liberation, movements for national liberation, movements that purport to represent an ethnic group, there's always a danger there, especially when you talk about a single ideal. You know, the idea of one leader, one nation, one God, one leader. It sounds eerily familiar. And, you know, if the analysis that you're giving tonight is that, you know, many of us are looking for that one black man or that one black woman that will somehow, you know, provide the guidance and the leadership and basically tell us what to do, chapter and verse. If what you're saying is true, and we need that in order to confront situations like Jordan Davis, then frankly, you know, I think we're in a lot of trouble. And with everything else that we've talked about, and like I said, I mentioned Philip K. Dick today because, you know, a lot of black people are not, a lot of Native people are not particularly conscious of his written work, even though they've seen Total Recall or they know about it, or some of his films that have been, I mean, some of his books that have been adapted to films. But, you know, this consciousness of who we are and where we are, you know, we really need to talk about this because we have situations where black people are basically, if they're not flat out target practice, we can go missing in any community, anywhere in the world, and nobody cares. Even to the point where brother was bringing up earlier, some of us do not care. The more of a stake that we think we have in the extant system, the less we care about each other, because that's another nigga that's trying to get that nickel that I'm trying to get. And, you know, it's, you know, I don't know where else to go with this, brother. So, you know, thank you for being on, man, and for offering, you know, again, your analysis on this, because I don't think there's enough analysis being done. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of tears. There's a lot of marching. There's a lot of Facebook pages. But, you know, at the end of the day, where are we? We're living under a black president, under the most power that black people have had politically ever. In probably, well, if you take into account that the United States controls the entire planet, this is the most powerful the black community has ever been in world history. But a young black man can't even, you know, basically get into a crawl with a white man without being shot to death. And then for the jury to, you know, find an excuse and a reason to not call the crime what it was. which was cold-blooded murder. Malachi Daniels, at Fanonian on Twitter. Check out his work. Thank you for being on.
All right. Thanks a lot, brother.
I got stuff going through my mind right now. You know, I just don't, you know, how does a sane person, you know, deal with this? How does a sane, civilized, Asiatic black man trapped in the wilds of occupied North America, you know, how do we deal with this? How do we intelligently deal with this? You know, how do we spiritually deal with this? You know, how do we remain human and deal with people who do not recognize our humanity, and without, you know, basically jumping to, you know, the type of action that they want you to jump to then justify the boot that's going to be put down on your neck. You know, we have to outthink these brothers and sisters, because they're constantly sitting up all night long, drinking whiskey and brandy, you know, thinking about how they can do us in. And it's about time that we start to really accept our situation and accept the fact that our survival is our responsibility. This is The Angry Indian, and you've been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio with Brother Malachi Daniels. Thanks for listening.
Brother, thank you for having me on. Little horse, it's a little late this way, about 2:18.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I'm looking at my clock. Yeah, sorry about that, man. Man, you know, you take care. And
you too, brother.
This is The Angry Indian. Thanks for listening.
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.